All right, we have been working through the book of Daniel, and we want to give a little bit of review. We are in chapter 8. We got partway through it last time, and we are going to do a little bit of review to catch up, refresh our thinking, and for anybody who missed the previous, to give a little bit of a glimpse of what we've already looked at. You'll notice that we are in part 2 of A Vision Regarding Colliding Powers. And the biggest issue to recognize there is that there are human powers and there is the divine power. That is the biggest area of colliding. And those powers of human origin are only able to function under the power of the Most High. So, quick review. The book of Daniel is essentially two parts. How many of you can remember, without looking, where it divides the book of Daniel? Chapters 1 through 7, and then 8 through 12. So you're getting a handle on it. That's good. So that's the breakdown, and Chapter 1 is the introduction. It kind of introduces us to Daniel and the overall context. Chapters 2 through 7 have to do with revelation regarding the future worldwide rule that's going to be taking place and the judgments that are going to be a part of that. And basically, it's communicating Yahweh rules over the kingdoms of men. That's the real issue that's communicated throughout this. There are a lot of things that the people of this world will be doing, but it is all under the Lord who reigns above. And then chapter 7, we said, was the hinge. It connects the first part with the second part. It is chapter 7 really picks up what was dealt with in chapter 2, as far as the kingdoms that were introduced, and expands a little bit more on that, and gives more information. And then chapters 8 through 12 are going to give more detail even on what chapter 7 has given. So that's the basic idea. Chapter 7 records the general history of the times of the Gentiles that is introduced here. That terminology isn't used right here, but it's used by Christ later in Luke chapter 24. And it has to do with the time of Nebuchadnezzar taking the Jews into captivity. That's the beginning of the times of the Gentiles, and it's going to continue until the Son of Man returns to earth at the conclusion of the tribulation period. And then chapter 8 reveals more detail about the second and third kingdoms in particular, especially how they relate to Israel. And so there's kind of a honing in on things here. So we want to think again about this vision. So we first of all have the description of the vision. And we saw the contextual circumstances were given in verses 1 and 2. The timing of it is near the end of the Babylonian Empire, the Babylonian era. And then the location within the vision is about 200 miles east of Babylon, which was in Susa. And then there are some specific names and places that were recognized, that were pointed out, and we noted one of the basic things we want to see is that they were real places, they were literal, and everything associated with this is understood to be real and literal as far as the predictions and the things that are communicated in it. Then the introduction of two common but aggressive creatures. The ram with two horns made aggressive movements in taking over places. And we'll see that this relates to a particular kingdom. And the ram corresponds to the second beast that was talked about in chapter 7 and relates to the image in chapter 2. And that has to do with Medo-Persia or Media-Persia. And that is specifically pointed out in verse 20, as we'll see. The male goat furiously attacked and trampled the ram. So we had this one kingdom, and then another kingdom comes along, and the goat represents or corresponds to the third beast of the vision of chapter 7, and that is Greece, as is specifically pointed out in verse 21. So Now, we want to review the text from here, because we got partway through this, didn't quite finish it, but a little bit of review, I think, is helpful, to because there are so many details, we kind of need to try to refocus our thinking on these matters. So verses 8 through 10 say, "Therefore the male goat grew very great." And again, that's talking about the kingdom of Greece. "But when he became strong, the large horn was broken." There was a large horn. That's a particular individual that's going to be recognized, what's going to be pointed out in the interpretation section. "The large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven." So again, we have this symbolism, these pictures that are communicating something in particular, very specific, that's going to be pointed out in a little bit. Verse 9, "Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host," which could also be translated army, "of heaven. And it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them." Question that we're going to want to ask is, what exactly, or who is this host referring to, and who are the stars referring to? Then looking at verse 11 and 12, "He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down." So we want to think about, okay, which sacrifices are we talking about here? Which sanctuary is referenced? Who is the prince and the prince of the host? What is meant there? Verse 12, "Because of transgression, an army," again associated with that word host, "was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down." Now, you notice earlier, I was talking about the sanctuary being cast down. Is there a connection between the same terminology that's used here? "Cast truth down to the ground, and he did all this and prospered." So we have this little horn that is sort of on a rampage. And so we need to figure out who we're talking about here. So that brings us then to the third section we had looked at last time, the demise of the goat and the growth of the little horn. So the goat grew strong and then was displaced. This description that we see here corresponds to the third beast in chapter 7, verse 6, the leopard with four wings and heads. And we again have pointed out that this is associated with Alexander the Great. And then when he died, his four generals that came up after him, when that corresponds rather clearly. "A little horn grew greatly and exalted himself over a people." Now, I'm putting in general terms here so we see what the kind of communicate what the text is saying, and then we want to see as we look at it what exactly is in view here. Well, a small horn grew out of one of the four horns that was referenced that came up after the singular horn between the eyes of the goat was broken or dissipated or died, as we'll note. "This little horn grew very great to the south and east and the glorious land." We noted the glorious land referring to the Holy Land, and the directions are associated with, for the point of view, looking from Syria, which is where the Seleucid group of the four different areas, four different lands and rulers came from. "So this oppression came to a head in December of 168 BC when Antiochus returned in frustration from Alexandria. And what he did then was take out his frustrations on the people of Israel, and that included desecration of the temple and of the altar. And it led then to the Maccabean revolt. And then after that, there was a dedication of the temple back from what this little horn had done, and that was the initiation of Hanukkah, or the Feast of Dedication, and then there was more suppression and further oppression that came after that. So then, I wasn't supposed to turn there yet. Hold on. Pretend like you didn't see that. Couple more things. Looking at verse 10, this little horn grew up to the host of heaven, and that caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth and to be trampled on by the little horn. So the question is, okay, who is this host? What is this referring to? Well, when you look up the word that's used here, this word that's translated host, it can mean military men, troops, heavenly entourage, heavenly bodies, service, battle, trouble, stars, and the Almighty. Which one do you want to go with? Well, that's a little difficult. How do you know? What's context? As is so often the case. It is not easily determined in this text just by looking at it or by looking at the word. So now many have looked at this and said, well, the stars may refer to the children of Israel as opposed to the little star, the literal stars in heaven, because Israel was predicted to be as numerous as the stars of heaven in Genesis 15:5 and a whole bunch of other places after that. They're also referred to as God's armies or hosts. Exodus 7:4, 12:17, verse 51, Numbers 33:1. The text refers to my armies or God's armies, and they are referring to the children of Israel in those contexts. And so also some scholars have pointed out that the reference to stars and hosts of heaven may be synonymous, and the text may be using apposition to say the host, even the stars. And so they are identifying those maybe as the same. Again, not absolutely definitive, but there seems to be some justification for that. Since the emphasis is on the desecration of the sanctuary, the context seems to favor the children of Israel as the recipients of this oppression. And that would seem to fit because historically the actions of that individual Antiochus Epiphanes certainly fits the description. So that has been the understanding. Then verse 11 deals with, again, what this individual, this little horn, is going to do. Again, assuming that this is Antiochus Epiphanes, sometimes understood as the illustrious one, that word Epiphanes, he was involved in desecrating the temple, and in the process he exalted himself basically in a position to say that I am superior to Yahweh because I put down his temple and put an end to things and desecrated it, and therefore he would be understood as putting himself over Yahweh. And he, of course, took the boastful name Epiphanes, which means a divine manifestation. But the Jews are kind of like us. You know, when you get a name, and for somebody that you don't really like, you come up with a name that sounds kind of like it, and then you use that instead. And the Jews referred to this individual, Antiochus Epiphanes, as Antiochus Epimenes, which means madman. We can identify with that. Not that any of us would have ever done that with any of our political leaders, but I suspect there's that possibility. So the basic idea here is when Antiochus attacks the sanctuary, he is attacking Yahweh and putting him down, putting himself as above him. And of course, Antiochus temporarily terminated the regular sacrifices that took place in the temple, and that included the daily morning and evening sacrifices, and therefore deprived Yahweh of the worship that he would normally have received. The reference to cast down would seem to indicate that the place of worship was prevented from functioning and being able to serve the Lord as according to its purpose. And it's also recognized that the actions that Antiochus engaged in here anticipate what the little horn of chapter 7 will do in the future. and that is understood to be the Antichrist. So there's a parallel between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Antichrist who is to come. And so that's, I think, helpful to recognize as well. And then verse 12 kind of indicates that God would give control of the host, we understand in the context, the Jews would give control over to this little horn, Antiochus. And then it says, because of transgression. Then the question is, well, what is the transgression here? Is it a transgression that the Jews have been engaged in, or is it a transgression that Antiochus is going to be guilty of? And in the context, and looking at verse 13 as well, it seems that it must be the transgression is related to Antiochus and what he is doing. And so it was providing opportunity for him to bring to pass, and maybe in the process, payment for transgression on the part of the Jews as well, but most likely it would be because of Antiochus giving him that opportunity to transgress the Lord as an anticipation of what he's going to communicating or projecting for the future as sort of a type of the Antichrist who is to come. So, also, Antiochus would not only terminate the sacrifice, but he would disregard the truth, again, using that terminology, cast down, and he did destroy some of the Torah scrolls, according to 1 Maccabees 1:56 in the apocryphal books, and in the process, he was successful. He did do what he wanted to do, and he did succeed to a degree for a time, and we always need to add that. When we see someone doing this kind of activity, they succeed for a time. You think back to the Holocaust. It looked like the German war machine under Hitler with the Nazis was unstoppable, but they weren't. And these other things, historically, we see there is much damage that can be done, but it is all under the Lord's overall oversight, and that has to be kept in mind. So this revelation in this text indicates that there is a coming ruler who will desecrate the temple, and he will abuse the Lord's people. And we understand that to be referring to Antiochus Epiphanes in this context, but this figure seems to be a pattern for a future malevolent leader that we understand to be the Antichrist. As we see, the progress of Revelation builds on this text and expands much more greatly, both in the book of Daniel and in the Old Testament, and then on into the book of Revelation. So now, that question, what does all of this mean for us? Well, just a couple things to touch on before we move into the next section. God has a plan for his people. The things that are happening in this world are not just willy-nilly. They're not just chance things. When some evil character comes on the scene, and we see bad things happening in our own time, we need to be reminded that it can only happen as the Lord allows it to happen toward some other purpose that ultimately can be worked out. And then he has made known his plan to his people. That's part of what we have in these chapters. It's being specifically communicated. So there is purpose in that. And the plan has both near and far implications, even to the end times, as we'll see. And it includes the times of the Gentiles and the preservation of his people through it. But not all of his people are going to make it through it, but there will be at least a remnant. And we see that remnant theme rather consistently throughout Scripture. And even in our own time, in our own nation, we see there's a remnant of people who consistently follow the Lord, who recognize Him, who receive the provision of salvation. Not all do. And so we need to be reminded of that as well. But what we need to recognize is that we can trust Him. We can recognize that He does have our best interest in view, even though there are difficult times and situations that we may have to deal with, as the children of Israel also did. And so if we can entrust ourselves to His bigger plan that He has for the world, we can also entrust ourselves to Him for the little things that we have to deal with on a daily basis. So then, moving on then to verses 13 and 14, we read, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation underfoot?'" That seems to be that reference to the desolation that would be associated with the little horn that we would understand to be Antiochus Epiphanes. "And he said to me, 'For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed.'" So we just might have a question or two as it relates to some of this. So the concern about the timing of the things in the vision. A question was asked concerning the timing of the desolation. The holy ones that are speaking here, we assume, are likely angels, and the transgression in view seems to be that of Antiochus, not the Jews themselves, though there could be some element of that. And, of course, what's going to take place here, this transgression, is going to be very troubling to the Jews, because it involves a desecration of the sanctuary, their most holy place, their focus, the place that's associated with the presence of God. So this is a very serious slap in the face to them. The holy place that's noted here is understood to be the temple in Jerusalem, and the host that's referred to is understood to be the Jews, based on these other texts and observations in the context in particular. So the angel wanted to know how long the desecration of the sanctuary and the persecution of the Jews would last. The answer that's given is directed to Daniel for his own understanding and for his ability to comfort his people in light of what he's seeing in this vision is going to be taking place. So the angel said the desecration would last only 2,300 evenings and mornings. Now, many commentators take this to mean 2,300 days, or 6 months, or 6 years, 4 months, and 20 days. Since the Jews tend to ascribe the 24-hour period as morning and as evening and morning, looking back to Genesis chapter 1, verses 5 through 31. Now, there are others who look at this and they assume or maybe guesstimate that the total of 2,300 evenings and mornings means 1,150 of each, or there would be 1,150 24-hour days. In that case, talking about 2,300 evenings and mornings would mean 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices. Now, that is a possibility. Other interpreters have tried to explain it as days instead of years, or as years instead of days, but the reference to the evening and morning seems to suggest it's got to be days. I think the Seventh-day Adventists see it as years, and they then associate it with Christ's entering into heaven in 1844, if I remember correctly. But that doesn't fit a lot of things, so I'm not going to go there. So this period seems to indicate the duration of the period that Antiochus is going to be doing his worst to the temple and to the Jews, and it would fit at least within the years of 167, 164 BC, and probably overlap beyond that, because his influence certainly was greater than that. And so most evangelical responses would assume that this is talking about 2,300 days. And probably the emphasis on the days is sort of to communicate something of the long, hard duration that is going to have to be endured during this time. Of course, that would be troubling to know that this is what is going to be happening when you hear of this. Now, one way to locate the fulfillment of this time frame is to identify the end of the 2,300 days and then work back from there as to when it is going to formally begin. And sometimes some of these things are not real easy for us because we are a long ways from when this took place. And so the question then is, did the angel mean that the period would end with the restoration of the holy place, or that the restoration of the holy place would follow sometime after the end of the 2,300 days? So trying to figure out, okay, exactly when are we talking about here? And the text doesn't really give us an answer to that. But we do have a record of when the first Hanukkah celebration was, and that was December of 164 B.C., and it may be that this is the time of the reconsecration of the temple that the angel was talking about. Another alternative that has been suggested is that the full restoration of the sacrifices may be in view, along with the religious independence of the Jews that came a few months later. But in either case, you're talking the same basic year of 164 BC or shortly thereafter. So that time frame is fairly close. And so then the 2,300 days would seem to be associated with that period of persecution that came and the domination of the Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes. And even if we can't identify exactly when it started or when it completed, we have an idea of that's the emphasis that's there. And it was interesting. I noted an illustration that was communicated. It says, a persecutor of the Jews in Russia asked a Jew what he thought the outcome would be if the wave of persecution continued. This was in Russia. And the Jew answered, well, the result will be a feast. Have you already figured out where it's going? Pharaoh tried to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Passover. Haman attempted to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Feast of Purim. And then Antiochus Epiphanes tried to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Feast of Dedication. So all you got to do is bring on the persecution, and we'll have another feast when it's over. Not exactly feasting during, but anyway, I thought that was an interesting observation. So moving on then to the interpretation, which we've already done a bit of, because we have seen the whole text and can deal with it as we go through it. So maybe we can go through this part a little bit quicker. So looking at verses 15 and 16 and then 17 through 19, then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. Well, how do you make someone understand something? I've been trying to do that for years, and I still wonder, is it really getting through? My wife tries to make me understand things, and I'm a little slow at catching on. So you can relate to that. So he came near when I stood, and when I came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. So there's a little bit of a time frame referenced here. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. In other words, he fainted. But he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. So we're talking about something happening in the future. We need to look at the details just a little bit more. So there's a need to understand the message of the vision. Daniel recognizes a need to understand, and the beings that are present, which we assume to be angels, also recognize his need to understand. So there was a concern for understanding the vision. As in the previous vision in chapter 7, verse 16, Daniel needed help to understand what he had seen. If we had seen something of this nature in a vision, we would need help understanding it as well. So he saw someone that looked like a man standing before him. Evidently, again, we assume it was an angel. He also heard a voice that he could understand coming from the canal. Was it the voice from God? Was it an angel? Doesn't specifically say, but an angel was instructed by name to give Daniel understanding. This named angel is Gabriel, and Gabriel means either God has shown himself strong or strong man of God. Either way has some significance. And Daniel is only one of two angels that are mentioned by name. The other one is Michael. And these names are in the Old Testament only found in Daniel. They aren't found anywhere else. Daniel 9, 21, 10, 13, 21, and 12, 1. And then also in the New Testament in Luke 1, 19, and Luke 1, 26, and Jude 9. But the use of the personal name would seem to suggest something of the importance of the vision and the interpretation. And when there's something important to communicate, God makes it obvious. And we think about when the birth of Christ was anticipated and told to Mary. It was Gabriel who was there as well. So, again, another important event to recognize. There was an expression of fear in the circumstances. Anytime an angel shows up, people usually do something that indicates they are afraid. And the angel usually says, "Do not be afraid." And they already are. So that's a bit of a problem. So Gabriel's approach to Daniel in this time made him so fearful that he fell to the ground. And he's referred to as, the title here, Son of Man, indicates his humanity, and probably in contrast to Gabriel. And it's probably stressed the human weakness that's part of our nature. But it also communicates something of not only the solemnity, but also an element of encouragement that this message is being communicated, and it's a bit of an honor for just an ordinary human being to have a message of this magnitude communicated to him. So Gabriel introduced his interpretation by explaining that it concerned the time of the end or the end times, verse 19. And so this vision deals with the events yet future from Daniel's point of view in his own historical context. And the time of the end that's used in Daniel, it's a similar reference to the day of the Lord that other prophets refer to. And it can be a more immediate future day, or it can be an eschatological day, or the time of the end, depending on what the context is. And so Daniel's response to Gabriel's presence was that he fainted. The Hebrew word that's used here, it denotes a coma-like state of deep sleep brought about by supernatural agency, especially in connection with visionary experiences. That sounds like a quote from some commentary. Some theologian is waxing eloquent. We would just say he fainted. It's a lot easier than all the other words that were used there. But a coma-like state, we can understand. Gabriel proceeded to revive the prophet and then to prepare him to receive the remainder of the interpretation. There was an emphasis on the time of the end. It's noted a couple different ways. So Gabriel clarified what he was going to explain was going to be taking place in the latter time of the indignation and the appointed time of the end. And this was obviously future from Daniel's point of view. And yet it does refer to a time of Antiochus particularly, but does it also refer to something else? Well, we see there are many that think, well, this is a not just one or the other, it's likely both. So most premillennial interpreters believe that it refers to both, at least in some sense, either in a double fulfillment or as a type anti-type. And some have also pointed out that the difference between a double fulfillment view and the type anti-type view is probably simply semantic. It's not that much difference. It's whatever term you want to use, it's something that happened here that has some implications for something that happens in the future. And so that's likely the case here. I think there's legitimacy to that. So the conclusion that the prophecy relates to both times rests on what follows in the verses of 23 to 25 and then other uses of the phrase the end in Daniel, like 9, 26, 11, 6, 27, 35, 40, 45, 12, 4, 6, 9, 13. Those should be in your notes if you're looking up, if you want to check those out. But there are other examples of a double fulfillment or a typological fulfillment that are part of what took place in Jesus' experience. There were things that happened earlier to Moses, to the Israelites, to David, that had significance for the Messiah, for Christ himself as well. Then, looking at verses 20 to 22, the ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. Can you get any clearer than that? I mean, it says it right straight up. And then the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king, who happens to be Alexander, known as Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. The four kingdoms will not be as potent as what Alexander was when the kingdom was divided among the four generals. The delineation of future kingdoms and kings in the vision. That's what we see in these verses, and this is quite simple and clear, so we'll simply note it. The ram represents the kingdom of Medo-Persia. Gabriel identified the ram with the two horns as Media and Persia, and there are liberal interpreters who want to assume that Daniel couldn't have known that, and so he figures, well, it had to have been written much later, and therefore they discount these things. But we just take the text for what it says. The goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the little horn on the goat is the first king of Greece, which is Alexander the Great, and then the four kingdoms that arose to replace Alexander when he died were to the west were Macedonia and Greece, to the north were Thrace and Asia Minor, to the south Egypt and Palestine, and to the east Syria and Persia, just to recognize, and then the relative kings that we've already mentioned previously. So most conservative expositors agree that verses 20 and 22 have been fulfilled completely in history in connection with Medo-Persia and the Greek empires and the four divisions following Alexander the Great. Now, are there other things to think about? Well, let's look at the next section of text, verses 23 to 25. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, so there's some transgressing going on, violations of the Lord's laws and expectations, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. All of that sounds disconcerting. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully. He will cause great fear in his destruction. He shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty. There are some mighty ones that will be destroyed, and also the holy people, who is in view here, talking again in the context about Israel. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. He shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. He shall be broken without human means. So there's a bunch of stuff that's dealt with here. The description of the exploits of the future fierce king. The identity of this ruler is not generally contested. There aren't many who don't recognize that this was referring to Antiochus Epiphanes. There are just too many parallels that make it pretty obvious. Looking at 1 Maccabees 1:10 would correspond with that. He arose in the later period of the four kingdoms that came into existence after Alexander's death. Antiochus Epiphanes was both bold and deceptive. He was powerful because God allowed him to be so. As the text says, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He was allowed to be so. He did much damage, destroyed fearfully, it says, especially to Jerusalem and the temple. He became prosperous and carried out his objectives. He destroyed powerful people. That included the Jewish high priest and many of the Jews. And he fooled many of the people with his shrewdness. He was trying to communicate that, you know, he wanted what's best, and he, you know, what he was trying to do to bring all peoples together was a good thing, and all of that. Kind of sounds like what we see from time to time in our own time and what we see in the text looking toward the Antichrist in the more distant future. And then he exalted himself. He even had coins minted that bore his image with the inscription God Manifest or Theos Epiphanes. And then he resisted, rose up against the Prince of Princes, which is referring to God or his son Christ in either context. So he was an aggressive, oppressive figure. He was angry that the Jews didn't go along with his ideals. We have some of that going on in our world. There seems to be another more future connection. And so many students of Scripture of these verses have noticed a striking similarity between Antiochus Epiphanes and another political leader that's predicted to appear in the future. And there are a number of texts that deal with that. And so this is a connection between Antiochus and Antichrist. And you'll notice both of their names start the same way. I'm just kind of kidding about that. I'm reminded of some of those things, Kennedy and Johnson, Abraham Lincoln and Johnson, and all of these different analogies that people make. You don't want to go too far with some of these things, or you come up with some crazy responses, because then you end up with the names Batman and some other political figure have the same letters in them. And it's like, oh yeah, that's right. That's really scary. But anyway, it is interesting that they do start out the same way. And also when we were in Sunday school this morning, Pat was pointing out Antioch of Syria and Antioch of Pisidia. Where did Antioch come from? Is that named after Antiochus? One of the Antiochuses, perhaps. I haven't looked it up, but the thought just came to me as I saw that. So anyway, there seems to be a connection that's more than just incidental in this. And so much of the New Testament and what flows from this text would validate that kind of understanding. Then looking at verses 26 to 27, and the vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true. Therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Well, that sounds a little dramatic. That's kind of heavy stuff. So let's think about the validation and results of the vision. There was a reference to timing implications. Some have suggested another title for the vision may be the vision of evenings and mornings, probably related to the sacrifices that were mentioned earlier. The phrase seems to describe the particular period when the prediction would find fulfillment. Again, we're assuming 167 to 164 BC in that time frame. And then Daniel was instructed to seal up the vision, probably in the sense of recording, finishing, and preserving it, probably not so much in the sense of making it secret so that nobody can see it or read it, because it was obviously made known and is referenced to no one understood it, so it must have been communicated at some time in some way. And it's indicated as being a trustworthy message and having implications for days in the future. There was a physical toll from the revelation. Now, I have not received a revelation of that nature, but what comes to my mind is when King Josiah encountered the word that had been lost in the temple for a number of years, and when sometimes the people of Israel had not been exposed to the truth and they get it out and they hear what God's expectations are, it takes a toll on them. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff. If this is for real, how do you deal with this? And Daniel seems to be in that situation, but he was in the presence of the angel Gabriel himself and perhaps another angel, suggests from the context. And he felt worn out from this. It's like when you've had a dream that was very active and you wake up and you feel exhausted because it was a lot of energy expended in the process, even though you're supposed to be sleeping and getting rest. Your mind is busily going in several different directions. And this was much heavier than that. And so it may be that he had a sense of the spiritual warfare that is going on or going to be going on in the future, and that weighed on him as well. But in any event, this was a troubling thing for him, and he probably had an understanding that this was going to bring about severe persecution to his people, the holy people, and that would be distressing. He had already been through the Babylonian captivity, and he had been in exile, and he had seen all of that. Now you have this that's coming in the future, and it sounds even maybe worse than what they had gone through before. And so it's not surprising that that would weigh heavily upon him. And then it seems as if Daniel came away still not fully understanding everything, and he sort of had to live with maybe some unanswered questions, though the Lord was going to give him some further revelation in the future. There are times when we look at texts like this and we come away thinking, yeah, there's a few questions I still have, even though I've spent time on it, I don't know that I have it all figured out. And we have to be able to live with some unanswered questions as well. But let me just give a quick summary of some of the observations that we've seen here. The emphasis of this chapter is on the little horn. And the emphasis in chapter 7 was also on the little horn, but two different individuals are in view. But there seems to be a correlation between them. One may be prefiguring the other. The little horn in chapter 7 is the Antichrist, and in chapter 8 it is Antiochus Epiphanes, and it it seems like there is a short range, closer range understanding, and then a longer range view that we need to keep in mind. Chapter 8 focuses on the Jews as the target of Antiochus. Chapter 7 focuses on believers generally as the target of the Antichrist. But there seems that maybe there's a little bit of a hint in both chapters that there will be a long-range focus on the Jews in the future as well. Of course, other scripture testifies to that reality. The times of the Gentiles will result in persecution. The entire time was not a persecution of Israel, the entire time that, you know, we're even in now, but there are plenty of occasions where that is going on, and of course we see anti-Semitism throughout history has been a major factor and continues and even seems to be intensifying today. Of the four empires, only Persia was relatively kind to the Jews. And that was at least for some of the time. They were at least given opportunity under Cyrus to be able to go back to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the temple. As Christ indicated, the times of the Gentiles is characterized by treading down of Jerusalem and the subjugation and persecution of the people. This is Luke 21:24. And so Jesus refers specifically to several things that are referenced in Daniel, as we will be seeing more in the next chapters. And so both Jesus and John in the book of Revelation in particular expand on this prophecy. And so next we'll have an opportunity to look at how Daniel is going to be elaborating on this. But there's going to be sort of I think Pat used the word excursus, a little bit of a diversion into another area, as we'll see when we look at Daniel chapter 9.